Friends, to everyone on the spectrum and in between, welcome to another episode of the Shudder Show. My name is Ken Stacknick, and with me, as always, is
David Marlowe.
And not with us, as always, our special guest,
Andy Green. Round two,
Andy Green.
Oh man, I'm feeling as hot as love today.
Oh my God, Andy. And so you're feeling hot as love, Ken. How are you doing, good sir?
I am just peachy keen. That is how I'm feeling today. I'm full up of preservatives and delicious fruity goodness.
I thought you were gonna like say like embalming fluid or like all sorts of different things, like took you from the cemetery today.
I mean, that's a way to be on theme.
We gotta mix things. Yeah, we gotta mix things up. You know, it's Halloween season. I gotta chuck and move. I gotta keep things lively.
Yeah, makes sense.
So apparently there is a game that exists, sort of a horror game that exists where you play kind of the mortuary's assistant. Mm. And you're going in and pretty much your job is to just prepare bodies for burying. And then in between bodies, like you're filling out the paper.
Like, is this a tablet game?
I don't know if it's a tablet game. I think
I was envisioning like a card game, and like was like, how does this work?
I can't remember off the top of my head what it's called, but like as you go through the mortuary to go file and fill out paperwork, apparently the bodies that you are going through are haunted or possessed by the devil, and just weird shit starts happening in the mortuary where you're working. But then you listen to a recording and the mortician's just like, oh yeah, by the way, this is a thing. You know, I just need you to do a couple of things on each body. I need you to learn the demon's name. I need you to figure out just what kind of demon it is. And then meanwhile, the whole time, like while you're working on the body, I can just think, is like, why would anyone think that this is the most dignified way to dispose of your body? Just like they go through the actual process of what it is, like literally like making small incisions in the side of the neck, inserting tubes, having everything like literally drain out of you and just replace it with this unnatural chemical that keeps your body from actually decaying.
So you know so much about this game, but you don't know where or what it's played on? I don't.
Or what it's called?
I think it's called the Mortuary's, the Mortician's Assistant.
Ah, okay.
If I'm not mistaken, it's been like I played it a couple of weeks ago.
That sounds like a joke that like all the morticians tell. Like it's like the aristocrat joke for like comedians. Yeah. Like you heard the one about the mortician's assistant, and each one has their own like gag for it. I don't know.
you just keep agreeing that like oh no, that's definitely a thing I've experienced.
Turns out the autopsy of Jane Doe was all just a prank by Dad.
It's like 6 feet under, but gone wrong. Like the just dad horribly, just like, sorry, I was keeping the demons at bay. Now you family, you have to deal with it. That'd be a great show.
It was 6 feet under, but funny.
Yeah.
Oh, good sir. Andy, what are you drinking today?
I wasn't prepared. I am drinking water today. I have a reason for this. I thought about it. I have a pumpkin beer in the fridge, but I am doing a lot of voice work and need to preserve it. Beer is not good. I know it's a very lame, boring, but I got to keep you on your toes in a very boring way. So that's what I'm doing. Water today.
I'm being irresponsible today and sticking with a fancy gumball head.
Ooh.
Which is from by Three Floyds. The title being It's Not Normal.
Yeah, looks like
what
they spend
claim.
Money on the label. Yeah.
Yeah. No, this is one of those beers that's actually kind of hard to get into, even though it's brewed here. It's actually pretty popular. There's a couple people when it goes on sale, you're literally only allowed to grab like 2 six-packs of it. So
yeah, Three Floyds is like one of the best breweries in the country, if not the world. Yeah. So good work.
Ken, what about yourself? What you drinking?
I'm drinking Chardonnay, like a lady from
Yeah. Like
I'm
drinking the Lady of Lavender.
Yeah. Yeah. I got real soccer mom energy going on at the moment, which is fine with me.
I love that.
Some gorgeous soccer mom energy filled with an old creepy man.
Yes, absolutely. Hey, I am not old.
I got to say, so the movie that we're talking about, it is so hilarious because I watched, what's the documentary called? It's another play on Phantasm.
Phantasmagoria?
Phantasmagoria, thank you. I was watching that documentary yesterday and today, and it's hilarious how the old man did not know that he also had a female counterpart. And he seemed slightly uncomfortable by it.
And she didn't know either, right? Yeah.
No, neither of them knew. And they're both just kind of like, every premiere of this, of every sequel, there's always something that the actors really just don't know that's a key pivotal point in the plot. One of them being that, the woman knew that there was going to be full frontal nudity, but that she was uncomfortable with. So they gave her a body double, mm-hmm. but her mom didn't know. And so, they were just full frontal, just everything there. And then she gasps, looks at her mom, and her mom just takes a look, and they're like, they should have just used you. Your tits are much better.
Mom,
you know what? I love that mom. Like, that's yes, critical support
that is,
right there.
That is
like,
mom of the year right there.
Yeah.
You got great tits, honey.
Yeah.
I thought that story was going to end with her the screening being ruined or whatever. Cause that's like the opening scene, right? That's within 37 seconds.
Oh, yeah.
So what a cool mom. What a cool movie. What movie, by the way? I think you said the documentary, but what's the original title?
Everybody, we are talking about the cult hit Phantasm.
Oh, is that the wrong
one? Now,
Don Coscarelli's Phantasm.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ken, how have you seen all of the sequels that accompany this? Or
no,
what's your experience with this?
I am going to be very upfront. I am super late to the party with Phantasm. It was one of those movies that I saw the cover for in Blockbuster, but for whatever reason, I just kind of never got around to it. And then I was hanging out with my buddy, Ben DeMarie, who is also the DP of Sharknado, humble brag. And he was like, hey, have you seen, I got the new copy of Phantasm. And I was like, I've actually never seen it. And he was like, okay, well, you have to see it. And it is fascinating to me that J.J. Abrams made a movie when I assume J.J. Abrams was 3 years old, because this is the most mystery. Like, I understand why J.J. Abrams loves this movie, had Bad Robot help put it out. It is such... none of it makes sense, but it's pretty cool, and that's why it's fine, because don't worry about it, you know what I mean? But it's undeniably fun and cool, and there's neat stuff going on, and Angus Scrimm is rad, even if he's just a weird tall guy.
I picked this film for Halloween month.
Yeah.
Specifically because this is my first viewing of it.
Oh, okay. Yes.
We had to bring Andy on.
Yes. Totally.
This is absolutely why we had to bring Andy on, because Andy made a mention when we were chatting on Instagram about how big a fan he is of this franchise.
Well,
I'm like,
I'll jump in. I am a huge fan of this film. I've seen it like 4 or 5 times now, and it's the same thing where I'm not entirely sure if I can ever tell you what the hell I watched, or I have like no memory. It kind of invokes the movie itself. It's like this nightmare dream scenario, but I feel like I've fallen asleep multiple times. It just doesn't stick with me, but in kind of a really cool way. except for the music, which to me, and I was waving the vinyl, like Fred Myro and Malcolm Seagraves, like that sticks with me for sure. But I'm like the kid at like Christmas who staggers presents as long as possible, who like saves the best one for last in my estimation. So with Phantasm, I really liked the first one so much. I actually have not gone beyond it. I'm doing a very long saver experience here. And I have seen two. But I don't want to talk about that for this one. But I don't want to come off as like, oh, I'm the king of Phantasm franchise. I just fucking loved this first one. And I also thought it was funny. I was like, Carrie, I'm not an expert at all on, but like, oh, Phantasm, I have the fucking vinyl. Like, I'm ready.
Well, like, one of the big things that, like, with this show that David and I have talked about is we are not interested in having a show where we tell you why stuff on Shudder is something you should shit on. That doesn't make any sense to me. To me, I would much rather, like, Street Trash is our first episode. And that to me is a great episode, a great example of what we're trying to do here, which is, hey, are you a Steadicam operator? Do you like big, long, weird oners? Well, here's a movie you've never seen everybody steal from all the time, but it contains all of those things. And that is why you should watch it. And this, I think, is a great example of a movie where you should watch it because it is a great example of the mystery box that J.J. Abrams sells, which is it doesn't have to make a whole lot of sense as long as it's kind of fucking neat. And this falls underneath that because this movie makes almost no sense. Like every scene seems like a pitch from someone who's like, how do I keep people watching for the next 15 minutes? And they're like, tits. And they're like, yeah, that'll work. What else? I don't know. What if the tall guy's really strong and he can just throw like a whole coffin in the back of a hearse? Sure. Yeah, that sounds great. What else? I don't know. Flying orb flies in your head, drills your brain out. Why? I don't know. Would you watch for 10 more minutes? And the answer is
yes,
I will, actually. Why is there a hatch on the island? Fuck if I know, JJ. Just keep the show going. I don't care.
The orb, I feel like, earned me 5 movies. Like, that orb scene is like, okay, I'll see all of these now because of that first orb kill was just so cool. And then just, like, the cherry on top is, of course, the squirting out the end. Like,
hope there's like episode 4 is like the Geppetto where he's like, hey, I'm a guy making an orb and I'm doing a thing and he's just knocking it together and he's got creative complaints.
Orb,
I don't get to make Phantasm movies.
That orb was not cheap, by the way. I think that orb, it was made by a local craftsman, a guy named I think Willard Green was his name. It was made it for around $1,100. So that tiny little orb, like, I mean, that's about a week's worth of pay for me.
Money well spent.
One of my favorite little stories is so if you guys have seen Cabin in the Woods, Drew Goddard, the director of that movie, was very insistent that the art department was going to make that coffee drinking bong, it was going to be fucking practical. So like $6,000 later they absolutely done it, and like, and Drew Goddard was like, look, I understand, I've gotten a lot of emails and Twitter messages from people being like, how can I get this? The answer is, it costs $6,000. That's your answer, leave me alone. Like, which is one of those directing things that you hope you can do. You can insist to the art department, no, we're doing it practically. Like
the baby Yoda of Cabin in the Woods was just collapsible, like, bong.
The baby Yoda doll costs like $4 million, and at one point Jon Favreau had to come downstairs and be like, hey, I know you guys are having fun poking at a baby Yoda. I'm gonna need you guys to calm down. That costs $4 million. And he just like goes back up to his own office, which is just the best, most hilarious story.
Well, yeah, like you said, though, as the director,
the amount of millions that thing has made the company so far is just astounding.
Oh, yeah. $4 million was a very small. Yeah. At the time, he didn't know. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Also, at one point, Ken, did you think that Reggie Bannister in this film was Dean Norris? Because I totally thought he was Dean Norris.
It was one of those things where I was like, am I thinking about this too hard or not enough kind of situation? And I definitely checked the IMDb and I was like, okay, good. No.
Okay.
All right. I'm correct.
I mean, I'm impressed with my wife because she was sitting through a little bit of it when I was watching it. And I was like, oh, I think that's Dean Norris from Breaking Bad. She goes, I don't think that's him. So she has better eyes than I do, apparently. But
I think
it's so funny.
The ponytail is what does it. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That is a business in the front or business is closed at the front and party in the back.
Is it one of the most cinematic ponytails of all time? Especially since I know that he shows up in all the other ones.
That is like some 80s Die Hard ponytail energy right there.
Hey, 79 though. So he brought that to the 80s. Reggie Bannister did it.
Thank you, Reggie Bannister.
Thank you. Yes.
But it's so funny though. If you see in Phantasmagoria, they're talking about some of the stunts that were being done in some of the sequels. One of them, Phantasm 2, where they pull the character Reggie up against a wall, like 10 feet up in the air. They have a stunt double go in. The stunt double's fake hair is the most is just the funniest thing I have seen in a long time. It is just so obvious how fake it is and that someone pretty much just cut out a shape of like horseshoe shaped hair and just taped it to this bald man's skull and then just said, all right, throw him at a wall. It's just brilliant. Reggie Bannister.
His hair cannot be created again, you know, like it's really hard.
No. And he has to be the only cool ice cream truck driver.
Oh,
in
yeah.
Film history. Because at this point, marketing for ice cream trucks has not been the best. It's usually just creepy.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a huge surprise that he was like the cool, the cool uncle kind of character.
Which like as a kid, you see your uncle like, yeah, man, my uncle's got it. Like, man, he's got it made. He's driving an ice cream truck. He's playing music on the side. But then you become an adult and you're like, oh, this dude's not doing well for himself.
He's having
a midlife crisis.
Can you imagine what it would be finding like as an adult now? Like I am now over 40. The idea of finding out that my uncle had an ice cream truck and I used to think he was really cool when I was like 12 is like all the red flags now. Like, you know what I mean? Like in retrospect, you'd be like, oh no, 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 no. There's something I must be blotting out here. There's no way that ended well.
Like, and then meanwhile, in Great Britain, Rupert Grint used some of his Harry Potter money to buy a fucking ice cream truck.
That was probably like for one scene in the movie. Like he could turn that around for that profit.
Yeah. But I guess that's something that Rupert Grint's always wanted to do. Dude's always wanted to own an ice cream truck, which is just like, that's a very strange life goal to have.
Yeah. Dream a little smaller, amigo. Yeah.
He's already, once you've been Ron Weasley, you just gotta. Yeah.
He's like, I have nowhere else to go.
I feel like the ice cream truck definitely could have been used more, but I mean, of course they get to use it for like hauling a corpse, which I think was a terrible idea. Like, but you know, like, I feel like we could have gotten some music. We could have, I don't know. There was missed opportunity, but I don't know. I think my favorite part though, is when he just comes in for like when they're doing exposition time and he's just like, oh yeah, before the kids get out from like, what was it, like summer camp, you know, like that's what his day is like, timing when children come out and it's just such a weird it's weird
what a weird career path to go down. And then you know what, I lied, the other time I've seen like an ice cream truck that where it hasn't. No, actually, it's been pretty creepy. And it was Killer Clowns from Outer Space. I guess those guys were kind of perverts too. They were trying to pick up chicks.
They were very perverty, but yeah, they got what was coming to them. And then, of course, there's Clint Howard's Ice Cream Man. And that's exactly
the image that comes to mind.
Which one is Clint Howard in?
Well, I think it's just called The Ice Cream Man, or
I think it's called Ice Cream.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think it is Ice Cream.
Is it? Okay, let's see. Live IMDb here.
This is the same actor from Austin Powers, right? By the way, when they were doing the whole, it looks like a giant.
Yes, I think.
Such and such gag.
And of course.
Clint Howard? Do you not know who Clint Howard is, David?
Rest in peace.
There's so many different actors out there.
That's Ron Howard's brother.
Yeah.
Oh. Man, it's that.
He's in everything.
Yeah, I don't know which parent he got the looks for. Such a funny duality of Ron Howard is like, I'm the most milquetoast, like, approvable guy in the world. And Clint Howard is the guy that you cast before Steve Buscemi was Steve Buscemi. And like, it's just so funny that they are one is burnt and the other is white. Like it is the polar opposites of two things. It is very funny.
Yeah. That dude, he was, oh man, he has such a character actor look about him. It is he's one of those, he's the equivalent of like, he is definitely one of those actors like, that you would say, oh, that guy who was in that thing. Like, he should definitely be in that documentary. So he is the brother of Ron Howard, which I just now learned.
Well, yes, because also Ron Howard puts Clint Howard in everything because, you know, they're brothers. And he's like, hey, man, can I have some work? And he's like, absolutely, my brother. I will be glad to give you some work. but Clint Howard is also good.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
This is a real... It's like a Ted Raimi situation where you're like, yeah, but Ted Raimi's pretty great.
I love this ice cream truck tangent that we've all veered off.
It's like
off
half
on.
The episode. And it is called Ice Cream Man, 1995. And also, I was thinking another brother is like James Gunn's brother. That's another, like Sean Gunn. I feel like he's like on the same wavelength where he's great and he's in everything.
He's kind of like a mini Annie Serkis. And like he's, you know, he plays Rocket Raccoon and he plays a lot of like the mocap.
Yeah, he does all the mocap. Yep.
Yeah.
Oh,
but back on to Phantasm.
Well, this episode should make as little sense as the movie itself.
Exactly. It's all just a fever dream.
Yes.
It feels like Steven Spielberg sneezed in my mouth and gave me the flu. Like, it's not, you know what I mean? Like, it's not the best parts of Spielberg, but it's the most parts of Spielberg. Like, it was fascinating.
Like a teenager getting in trouble while trying to discover what's really going on.
I mean, like all of the weird stuff in this movie is like all of the weird stuff of the Amblin movies. Like when you start talking about what's actually happening in Back to the Future and you're like, Marty McFly is a weird sex creep. And you're like, but you know, Michael J. Fox, this is that exact kind of thing where like there's a lot of weird creepiness and there's a lot of like leering at girls, but like
and Doc is just as creepy.
Well, like, so like it's all like endearingly creepy, if that makes sense. Like it's like it is the idea that is also in the Amblin movies and in Back to the Future and in this, that like, well, there's like being a peeping Tom because you're a horny boy. And then there's like, you know, being a creeper and cranking it out outside some girl's window. And you're like, I mean, that's not that big of a distance actually, but sure. And this movie has that energy. You know what I mean? Where like it's everything is a little creepy. Everything is a little leery, but it's not overtly awful. Which for a movie in 1979, I gotta give the movie fucking credit because there's a lot of movies. We like Revenge of the Nerds is just a movie where they're like, isn't it funny that this guy rapes this girl? And you're like, no. And they're like, well, you know, the 80s. And you're like, no, No. And this movie gets away with it. And that's the most I'll give. Yeah. Like,
you turns know, out the writer of Animal House is actually quite a creeper.
Well, yes. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how to segue from this, but I was going to say, like, in terms, I think Mike, like, as being, he's very voyeuristic. Yeah, the kid is like watching everything, but it also sort of felt like if you put some logic on like a dream scenario, I often feel like I'm sort of just watching, you know, like I'm sort of helpless, especially. And then he is, you know, 13, 12, and he, like, at least the movie proper that we find out might not actually happen at all and just be a dream is that, like, his parents have died. And his brother is like the last person in his family. So it makes sense that he's like watching his brother like a hawk because it's all he has, you know? So there's that. But of course, the added benefit of, like, he gets to watch his brother, like, you know, fuck someone in the graveyard, maybe.
Well, good for you, but bro. Like, it's also, he's like 13, and there is a age range where I would say, like, they don't know what they're doing while it's happening. And then afterwards they're like, oh, actually that was fucked up. And you're like, okay, that was the proper response. But because you were 13, you just didn't know how to respond in the, like it's that, you know what I mean? Like that's the weirdness of the morality of this movie that I think I'm talking about is, like, it's never done with bad intentionality. Where, like, if
the idea is there's an innocent childhood behind it, yes. Even though at the same time he's riding a motorcycle, drinking beer, like driving a car, like a muscle car.
I mean,
firing guns, MacGyvering a shotgun shell.
Oh, he's like, a badass.
this is a badass 13-year-old. All right.
Okay. Yeah, there's a fine line from being very, like, investigative and, like, trying to figure out what the hell is going on. Because, I mean, it's like the classic, like, Amblin, Stranger Things thing of, like, the kids are the ones who know what's up. Like, you know, it's the brother being like, oh, shut the fuck up. You know, you're wearing the gaslighting shirt. Like, that's what they're all doing until he sees a finger in the box, right? That's finally in the mustard. You know, he finally is like, oh, this is weird. Okay.
Story checks out.
One of the things I want to bring up is, like, it's totally weird to me, right, that there's just a scene from Dune in this movie.
Yes,
right.
Yeah, and the box, the direct ends, and
it's a box filled with fear. Like, that's just a scene from Dune.
They even say, like, fear is in the mind, like, not fear is the mind killer, but like, exactly that. And then the cantina is called Dune's Cantina. I don't know if you caught that.
Yeah,
like,
Don Coscarelli apparently is a massive fan of Dune. And this is before it got turned into, like, a mini series. This is before, like, it was put on screen or anything. So he's like, OG.
Yes, this is before David Lynch's
Dune fan. Yeah.
Which, boy, is that movie insane.
I prefer that one to the new one. That's my hot take.
Wow, that is a fucking scorching take, my friend.
We can talk about it off.
To me, the new Dune is this newest one was like, oh, I understand it now. You get huge points for that because I've seen this like 3 times and I've never understood it. Anyway, we're not talking about Dune. We're talking about Phantasm.
Ken, you really hit the nail on the head. That is pretty much this film in this whole podcast. Is it's just a series of tangents that just goes off and then comes back, and the audience is like, wait, where are we? What's happening?
All right, so I think what this movie really is effectively is a really good haunted house. Like nobody ever goes to a haunted house and was like, the story's bullshit. Like, no, the story is this just a fucking haunted house, weirdo. What are you mad about? Where this is exactly like, it's just a bunch of, like, what is it? It's like a bunch of spooky, creepy ass little vignettes that all hang together and it makes for a great time. Is it you know what it is? It is an album of a bunch of great number one hits that isn't a particularly good album. But as a collection of number one hits, pretty fucking great. You know what I mean? Like a greatest hits album might be that band's greatest hits, but it's not the experience of them as artists. I kind of feel like that's what this is. Like, this is just a bunch of fucking bangers. Does it make any sense? No.
And who fucking cares? That's what I say.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
What was it like? Yeah. This thing was filmed over, like a year's worth of just, like, weekend shoots between, like, 6 and 8 months of post-production. And it's, I mean, like he made this with a bunch of his friends. Like, his mom was, oh God, she pulled like triple duty as like a designer, costumer. She also did background extra work on his film. His dad was a heavy investor and co-producer of this film.
Yeah.
This is, I will say, like Don Coscarelli is unbelievably fortunate to have so many people in his corner. And he has stayed, like, and this wasn't one of those shoots where everyone is like, there's so much drama going on. So-and-so was just so terrible. This isn't one of those films where you talk about it and he's like, God, what a tumultuous shoot, but look what we got. It's a, man, that was a pretty fun shoot. Stressful at times, but look what we got. This is great. Like, it's really fascinating. And he started, I think, was Don Coscarelli still a student when he made this? He was 23. I think when he started directing it, which, by the way, Don, fuck you, buddy. how dare you just.
Don is a hero.
Man.
Like, I would put him in the category, and I mean, I don't mean necessarily in quality, I don't really care, but like in the quality, like the echelon of filmmaker that inspires me to make movies, which to me is the most important fucking kind of director. Like Sam Raimi, Peter Jackson, like young them, and Don Coscarelli, I think they're like of the same ilk. And like when I watch this movie, it just makes me want to grab a camera and just like, yeah, go make it with like, that's what Reggie was like. You know, that's how I think the actor was like, dude, I just want to do like something Wicked This Way Comes. And they're like, well, I had this dream. Let's do this instead. You know?
He tried to buy the rights for that too. Right. But Disney beat him to it.
Yeah. Just beat him to it, which, and then like, then now he found himself a franchise. Good for him.
Yeah.
But like, and you were telling the story about how like Angus Scrimm didn't really know what the fuck was going on. But instead of like other scenarios where maybe he's pissed, like he shows up in all the other movies and is a hero. Like, so clearly he's okay with, but maybe not where he thought his career would go, but like.
Didn't realize he was in like the modern days, like solid cult transgender hit film.
Yes. Yeah. It's not Alec Guinness scenario where he's just like, fuck this, you know?
Exactly. But he took it like, and watching the interview with him was really kind of charming in that like he was a little weirded out by it, but he just kind of took it in stride, which I'm just like oh, he, like that seems like a cool old man right there who's just kind of like, all right, whatever, that's fine.
If every old man was like that, we'd be, oh man, our world would be so much better. Like, it reminds me of Danny DeVito, like when he was on It's Always Sunny, where he's like, I don't know what's funny now. Like, tell me. Like I want to know what you, like you young people, like I want to follow that. And that, like, that's how you learn. That's how you stay vibrant. And now he's like the voice of Jersey Mike's, our boy. Like, it's just like funny, but I just, you know, most people are so close-minded and he doesn't know.
Why is me greased up crawling out of a couch going to be funny? And you're like, just trust me, Danny. It's going to be the funniest thing.
And I mean, I'm pretty sure Danny's like overstating like the level of like, you know, downplaying his intelligence and humor. But I think the point is that like, he's there to play with, well, to play with kids. That sounds wrong. Well, like, you know,
like,
but yeah.
Well, like he's game. Like right, he's willing exactly. to roll the dice on like, and that's the big thing. Like he's not like, he's the opposite of Chevy Chase, where Chevy Chase is terrified of being the butt of the joke.
Mm.
Danny DeVito is like, no, I'm going to be so much the butt of the joke. I transcend everything.
I was the star of Twins.
Yes. No, I mean,
can you imagine if Danny DeVito couldn't handle being the butt of a joke? Like he'd had to probably get rid of that, like at age 5, you know, like,
I mean, that would be that. That's a really funny show.
Yeah.
Just Danny DeVito being like a Timothy Chalamet level of like, no, I will be lit from the left side. Thank you.
I would love to see that. I think that would be an incredible Danny DeVito performance. Like, absolutely. Also, mm-hmm. Danny DeVito, Timothy Chalamet as like not twins, but like whatever, like their next version of that would be a great film.
Like father and son?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Or I want to see a movie where Danny DeVito comes back. He's like, I'm you from the future.
Yes.
Just to Timothy Chalamet and just watch Timothy Chalamet's mind just break apart.
I want Timothy Chalamet to be his dad. Danny DeVito is his son. Now that would be
that's incredible. Is this what
stop drilling your head oil, Andy?
Phantasm, the Jawas that they
so weird that 2 years after Star Wars there's definitely Jawas in this movie.
But David
though, they came up with this before Star Wars was released, so this is just a huge coincidence.
It's they did.
This was it was like the Jawas stuff was like filmed before Star Wars even came out.
George Lucas and Don had like the same like dreams like coming together, you know. I don't know.
Did ayahuasca at the same party.
Also, just the fact that Don Coscarelli directed this at 23, but not only that, the first cut that he screened for test audiences like ran over 3 hours. His first cut was 3 hours long.
Which like, is insane, because this movie's like 81 minutes.
And it went about as well as you think it would. It was disastrous.
I want to see the 3 hour cut. So I know it's lost, but yeah.
I know it's lost. There's a bunch of deleted footage that you can see, but yeah, a large portion of that footage was lost. And God, I hope they find it someday, because
they use it in 4, right? They use it in Phantasm Oblivion. They use some of that footage, which is like, I'm like, that makes me pumped. Like,
that's baller. Like,
that's recycling.
And
and
Shudder's remaster of this, like the remaster cut of this is gorgeous.
Oh, gorge. Yeah.
Like, it's so impressive.
This movie cannot look better. Like, other than changing the way the movie looks. You know what I mean? Like, this is...
It was like the most backhanded thing.
Escape from New York is a great example of a movie that looks like shit. That's kind of the point.
Right.
And the 4K transfer is never going to look crisp because it's supposed to kind of look like shit. Same thing with like Texas Chainsaw Massacre is kind of the opposite. It's weirdly beautiful.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
For a movie that should be uglies, or actually better example, Last House on the Left. Doesn't matter if you make a perfect transfer of that movie, it's supposed to look like shit, and otherwise I don't know what you're like. I don't know what you're trying to do. This movie looks as good as it's gonna get. That to me is, this is a very scrappy movie punching above its weight. Like spending all of the money, like mausoleum, the burial,
right?
Yes, like, the house itself, which I think was the actual historic Dunsmuir house in Oakland, California. So they used it in A View to Kill.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
like I assume like all of that room is not actual pure marble. I assume a lot of that is contact paper, but it doesn't matter because it looks great.
It looks incredible. Yeah. When I read that it was not, I was like, damn, they did great work. Yeah. They like stumbled upon some really beautiful shots in this movie. I think the atmosphere of the movie is what I come back to and what I like want to bottle. And that's why I have the vinyl, because it's just like that little.
It's the vibe.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Well, that scene when suddenly
this movie.
Oh, that the cologne scene, would
for
be
example.
Rough.
Oh, my God.
Go to a dive bar and like the lady in lavender will just like come to you immediately, and that's when you know something's wrong. Like, no
essence of knife in the stomach.
Yes.
I think kind of like how you're talking about the mausoleum, and just like there's just getting these surprisingly stunning shots. One of them to me, like for example, was just that shot where the movie suddenly becomes a sci-fi horror film, and he's reaching into the portal to their planet, and just that shot they hold on where he puts his hand in and it just disappears. Like, I still, like, I wasn't able to find out exactly how they did that, but like, Man, it's just, it's genuinely impressive.
And yeah, it's such a 2001 vibe, which I know is what he was going for. But that, like, I'm assuming that's like that stuff is where the series heads, right? Like the other planet where there's like the Jawas and this wasteland and Tall Man's an alien. Oh, fuck. Like, what does that even mean?
I got some real, this is going to go Highlander route. And yeah. Man, if you're a big fan of Highlander, do not check out any of the sequels to Highlander. It is not. Man, I love Russell Mulcahy. I love the Highlander movie. I will go to bat for that movie. Sorry, man, there is no water down any of those routes. Like, I've looked, I watched the show. I'd love nothing more than to report, actually, the Highlander sequels are dope. Nope. Mm-hmm. That is just not how that worked out.
That's a negative 10-4, buddy.
Yeah. Yeah, that is a real bummer to report, sir.
Oh my god. There's when it does like make the shift to science fiction, I think that was unexpected for me. I didn't expect it to go the route of Aliens. Like that, granted, this film is not one of those films that really goes anywhere you expect it to go. But so, right. Like, what are those small creatures supposed to be exactly? Like, what are those?
Those are the victims, like, you know, like the guy at the beginning, their friend who dies, like they basically shrink them and become his slaves. Like, that's, I think they even say that at some point. Like,
I don't know, is that what they
that's
are?
What those like tanks are, like the toxic waste barrels. Like, I think those are them like aging, you know, like. Put them in like some fluid and then they come out looking like Jawas. But like, that's my understanding.
This movie is not at its best when it's trying to explain what it's doing. Like, that's like pulling Gene Simmons aside and being like, explain what Kiss is. And they're like,
right. No. We're just jamming. No. Yeah.
Yeah. We're just having a good time. Why do you like, need an explanation? And you're like, the more you explain, the worse it gets. Just like, and that's what this movie is. Like, it works because it's just like it's just a vibe.
Which there are I'm so many movies, with. Like including kind of like what you were saying, Back to the Future, where if you lay it out, lay the plot out on paper, and you explain it, you just kind of ruin it a little bit. It just
I would kind of send that to almost all movies. Like, I don't know. I don't go to a movie to like have it be expertly plotted and make sense because like that's like, I mean, reality doesn't really make sense either, but like, I don't know. The whole point is to be transported and this like definitely does that. And yeah, like it's so weird. I think it is like a jam session. Literally there's like a 5-minute jam session for no reason other than to have the tuning fork, I guess, foreshadow. Like it's so silly. I love that scene so much. Like he just shows up in between his ice cream shift and like, they don't even say anything. He just takes the guitar out. And it's like, I was hoping Ken, you have yours in the background. I was just hoping like, and at some point during this episode, you wouldn't say anything and just start.
just start jamming out. Just like, hey, man, this is what I'm going to do right now. Just go. Yeah, no, yeah. No, but
that's the movie.
But that's the movie. But there is a guy who brings a guitar out at a party and ruins the entire party. And this is not that. This is the guy who like brings the guitar out and you're like, look at you. Holy shit, did anybody know that Gary's good at guitar? Fuck yeah! You know what I mean? And like, and it's not, they play the guitar so well that everyone's like, you should go to Juilliard. What are you doing here? Like, no, it's just everyone's delighted that Gary's pretty good at guitar. And he played a great little song with a couple of great little limericks in it. And then we all went to bed. And it was the best night. And that's...
Yeah, nobody played Free Falling.
Yes, yeah. Nobody was trying to impress anybody. It didn't end with that guy trying to fuck somebody else's girlfriend. Like, he just
plays the guitar towards the host's wife.
It just turns out Gary's pretty good at guitar. And aww. That was what we wanted before we went to bed. Everyone's happy.
Yeah, it's a surprise.
Lemonade. Yeah,
it's so funny the actor who plays
Reggie.
Oh gosh, yeah, the
his name is Reggie. His
name is actually Reggie. Yeah. There's Bill Thornsberry and there's Reggie Bannister. I'm trying to remember. I think Bill Thornberry, like they're both artists. They're both musicians, obviously. There's another scene where they're playing together, and Reggie is kind of more the primary guitar player in that one. And he's actually recorded songs. Like he's actually like, I think he actually had an album at that point, and he had the most scenes that involved him playing his actual songs. And then there's only one scene with Bill Thornberry. He's like, well, it's like, I have this one song. He's like, we'll play it. We'll jam along. It'll be great. He plays it. All the rest of Reggie's songs get, all the rest of those scenes get cut for Reggie. And Reggie, they're interviewing him. He's like, I'm still bitter about it.
But is the other guy? Oh, sorry, go.
Because he was the actual musician and the guy who just kind of like pieced together his own little song in like a day or two.
The asshole in the Rolling Stones shirt and the little fedora. Yeah. Oh, man.
Like the antics on set, like it sounds like this was just a fun film to make.
Yeah.
It sounds like everyone just got along. There's like even like the relationship between Michael Baldwin and Bill Thornsberry, apparently still to this day, is spectacular. Like they got along so well, and like they were practically brothers, and it broke both Thornberry's and Baldwin's heart when they didn't recast Michael Baldwin for the sequel because Warner Brothers, man, they fucking suck sometimes. And like I get it, like too, like I think Don Coscarelli was put in a very uncomfortable position, and they brought him back for they brought Michael Baldwin back for three. And for the rest of the sequels, I think. But it's
something to look forward to.
But like during the scene at the end where the mansion disappears like into another dimension, you know, there's all this heavy wind and everything. And the actress, what's her name? Who plays the Scarlet?
The Lady in Lavender?
Sorry, the Lady in Lavender. What? Excuse me. The gumball head's getting to me a little bit.
You're becoming the gumball.
But it was apparently freezing outside. And all the while she's in this very thin dress and she's like, we need to get this done in as few takes as possible. Like I'm freezing my tits off. All the while Baldwin is behind the wind machine, just taking little pebbles and tossing them into the wind machine. And they're going in and pelting all the actors on the other side. And all the while he's just like a little grim, like,
all right, so he is that character. All right.
Yes. Oh, he exuded that energy constantly, apparently. And it's just like, and he's like, you know what? It's like, everyone likes to mention that one. It's like, they don't like to mention all the other fun stories about me because they're all old. And this is the only story that they remember. It's like, oh, so-and-so was throwing rocks into a wind machine. Pelt, pelt.
He was also like a kid. So like, yeah.
Yeah. No, it's like... And I think like Angus Scrimm, because I think he's Angus Scrimm, he's not originally born in the States, is he?
I feel like he's British, just judging by the name completely. Although I know that's not his, that's his stage name. I do know that, but.
Yeah, because that's his stage name. I couldn't tell. I wasn't sure exactly where it was that he hailed from. But he had worked previously with Don Coscarelli, and he came to him for this movie. And he's like, in this movie, I want you to play an alien. And to which then Angus Scrimm goes, great, what country am I from? No, you're
not that alien.
Like an alien. Oh, fun. Sure. Why not?
So he was actually born in Kansas City. So,
really?
Yeah. So not British at all. And yeah, we lost him in 2016.
Wow.
Tarzana, California. My first job in LA was in Tarzana, California.
God damn. Oh, but yeah, no. Like I highly recommend, like, along with this film that folks watch, like Phantasmagoria. It's such a great little documentary. With little like tidbits from all the different members of production and the actors, and it's and then they dive into the sequels later on. And at some point I might actually check those sequels out just out of pure curiosity. But
this is one of the first movies where I found a what can only be described as a crushing amount of behind the scenes information. Like, where my feeling was, look, if you really like this movie, go check out the 50 fucking hours of behind the scenes information that exists. I'm not gonna distill it all into 20 minutes because, well, if you really are interested, you should just go check it. Like, this is, there's movies that we cover here where we are struggling to find things to say that we can back up with sources. And this is not one of those movies. This is an incredibly well-documented movie, and we should be thankful for it. You know what I mean? Like, this is, if you want to know what the filmmakers were thinking, that information is out there. The interviews exist. You can go check that out. Where with a lot of movies, yeah, there's a lot of stuff where you find people being like, well, I think this person was saying this. And you're like, well, do you know that though? And this is one of those, you know, there's enough behind the scenes information on this movie. You can really find out about the intent, what they were trying to do. And also, yeah, what makes this movie great, which I think is, it's a bunch of, yeah, every single on this movie is a banger. I don't know how well it hangs together as an album, but.
I mean, Andy could probably tell you.
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, without the, it makes a lot more sense if you take away the visuals and you just listen to the album. Like, it's just, yeah. But yeah, well, I was going to ask you guys, like, I mean, it's obviously comes out before A Nightmare on Elm Street, but to me, like, there are some pretty obvious, like, parallels, even the, like, grabbing, like, him from the different things. It's so Freddy. And I don't know, like, I imagine it was maybe an influence, like, or it could be similar to the Jawas, where it just was like, they were making it at the same time as this and same ayahuasca trip.
if you consider that Wes Craven's first movie is Last House on the Left, which is just a remake of The Virgin Spring, Bergman's movie, like, it becomes much more of a, yeah, no, this guy is like, unlike, say, talking about Hitchcock and Peeping Tom, which was a movie that played in like one movie theater for like a week before it got banned. And maybe Hitchcock saw it, maybe he didn't. But like, no, Wes Craven has been very upfront. I remade Virgin Spring as Last House on the Left. So the idea then that Don Coscarelli is seeing, like, this is the, like, the series of years where these filmmakers are being saturated enough with this stuff that there's a very decent chance that, like, actually, yeah, Coscarelli probably did see this and then reinterpreted that into fucking Nightmare on Elm Street, or that Wes Craven, somebody who takes movies and definitely reinterprets them into his new lens, stole from this and turned it into Nightmare on Elm Street. I don't know which direction that went, but like, this is all the, I don't know, all these aromatics are definitely melting together and making the same stew.
Right. And so, and I think that's just what artists do anyway. Like, I wasn't necessarily saying like, ooh, they stole it or whatever. I just like the timing of it. And I think many people see like Nightmare on Elm Street as like this, you know, the first of its kind in some way, but like just some of those ingredients were already out there.
That's so now, all. Guys, if you had to guess what the budget of this film was, what would you say it was?
All right. So we know the orb was $1,100. We know mom had a couple jobs that was probably free.
I'm going to guess like $1.5 million.
Okay. $1.5 million for Ken.
I'll do prices right. I'll say $1. So anything under.
Oh, dear. Actually, Andy, you're closer. It was, so granted, like there weren't any accountants on set to really like fully keep track of everything, but like it comes to somewhere around like $300,000 budget, which then ended up netting over $13 million.
Like, and still counting, you know, they got our Shutter money today, you know.
Oh yeah, and it's, oh, Which is it's crazy that they only I don't think they have the other sequels on Shudder at this time.
They have at least four. They don't have two because I looked today. Yeah. But I think they might have three, four, and I think five was literally a Shudder exclusive. Like
was that one Ravager?
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
So it might just be two that's missing. But
which
two,
was what's also crazy is that this almost didn't become a cult hit simply because some asshole in the rating at the MPAA decided to like we're gonna give this an X rating. Oh, why do you want to give this an X rating? That's insane. Oh, because when the ball killed that one guy, he pees his pants.
Which is like this movie is so tame. Like
yeah, this is an R. Soft R.
Yeah. Yeah, like yeah. This is a real soft R. It's like
real soft R. But yeah, this asshole was just like we don't usually see people pissing their pants when they die, which
that was the most realistic part of this movie.
Exactly. Yeah. That's literally what happens. Everybody pisses their pants. Everybody shits their pants when they die. You're not escaping it. It's going to happen. And it was
innocuous. Yeah.
But there was a person who was a friend of, there was a critic who was a friend of Coscarelli's, and he was able to go to that member of the board and says like, come on, don't be an asshole. And his response was, okay.
Yeah.
That's about right.
And because of that, this movie got to be a cult hit.
Here we go.
And now Coscarelli is a cult filmmaker. Like, I mean, all of his films, like Bubba Hotep, John Dies at the End.
Hotep is so damn good.
Yeah. I mean, and there's others, obviously the other Phantasms too. Mm-hmm. Oh, man.
Ken, you've seen Bubba Hotep, right?
I saw Bubba Hotep in the theater, you piece of shit.
Okay. All right.
How dare you?
you shut your pretty little mouth.
Yeah. How dare you, sir?
Is this show like sort of David trying to find the movie that he's seen that Ken hasn't? And like, is that the running joke?
You found it, Andy. Well, this whole podcast was built on the concept that Ken just knows so much more about movies than I do. And it is constantly me trying to get the one up on him. Occasionally I do. And those are magical moments.
Yeah, it does happen.
But more often than most, Ken is a walking encyclopedia of film knowledge. And it annoys the shit out of me. Son of a bitch.
Well,
I like the dynamic.
Yeah, there we go. Well, on that note, Andy, do you want to plug any plugs that you have to plug?
Yeah, what you got going on?
Ooh, what has changed in a week since I answered this question? Well, I still have a podcast called The Naked Man Podcast. That's right. I am fully clothed, but not emotionally. Ooh, it is just all out, naked and vulnerable. That's on wherever you podcast. And then there's also a horror talk show on YouTube there's like 50 episodes. David is on one of them, House by the Cemetery. And that will return at some point. This year, I just did not have the life force to do it.
And you got to hop on. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. No, we'll come up with a movie for that whenever. We'll figure out what theme it is. I got to transform
gotta be obscure
into
as shit.
Obscure as shit is
Ken,
what I like.
Just get some Ken Russell's The Devils on there.
Oh my God. I actually have not seen it. So that'd be the perfect.
Sure. I love The Devils. Ooh. That movie's insane.
Ken Russell's. I mean, any Ken Russell that I've seen, I've loved. So yeah.
It's like every Ken's sexy nun that you've seen for Halloween, Ken Russell's The Devils was the basis of that.
He's a hero.
Yeah. Does she have a hunchback? No, not sexy, no.
But she is in space. She is in Space Jam 2.
That she is.
Wow.
Which,
yeah, like, no, Space Jam 2 has the most insane references of any movie. It's like, yeah.
But which beyond is, like, that, is that the only reason to see that movie?
From it is literally the only reason to see that movie. But it's so funny, though, because that movie came out around the time we released our episode on Ken Russell's The Devils. And so out of nowhere, that episode got a huge spike in viewership. And we're like, what the fuck's going on? And then turns out it was because the character of the Hunchback Nun is in
Space Jam 2.
It's just a background character.
Like for a movie that has not been released on Blu-ray because it is that controversial, they just put this character in the background of Space Jam 2 because fuck us, I guess. I don't know. Yeah.
Hey, the genius world is a timing strange place. On, yeah, the world.
Yeah. Somebody's my best friend in the whole world. And like, I want to find that person and just cuddle them.
Well, it's like, you know, that movie for those people probably was like one of the most miserable experiences. They're like, you know what? Let's put the weirdest fucking things we can in the back. Like there was a Devils fan working and let's.
Do you think that, think that background actor knew who they were?
No.
Just like, no, I do not. Like they're standing next to all these iconic characters. Then all of a sudden it's like, put her in this nun outfit. She's like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah, I'm probably Julie Christie or some shit. You know, this is fine. Yeah. That's, you know. This is some Sound of Music shit. You're like, no.
I would love if she was going method, you know, like she was just like really in that, you know, like there's a murder mystery on set. Like she just, incredible. I don't know. I'm assuming murdered people in the movie or bad things happen from the nun.
Oh, there's many a bad thing that happens in that movie.
I love many a bad thing. And that's why I'm always honored to be here. So thank you.
Oh, my God. Andy, we are so happy to have you here. Like, and like Ken said, you have an open invitation anytime you want.
I mean, I'm just going to come in, boy, and then just like grab the mic. Like, that's going to be my.
There we go. Perfect.
Now, Ken, where can folks find your pretty face, good sir?
Well, you can find me on Instagram and on Twitter at Ken Stachnik, KenStachnik. You can find us on Twitter on at Shutter Show. And other than that, you can also email us at shuttershow@gmail.com. David, where can they find you?
You can find us on Instagram at shutter underscore show. You can find me at underscore DW Marlowe, where I get up to my regular musings, woodworking projects, and occasionally a fun little pictures of me hanging out with my wife and puppy.
Yay. Wholesome entertainment.
Oh, Andy. Thank you so much for joining us. This has been just an absolute blast, good sir.
Thank you so much for having me.
I guess until next week, everybody, go fuck yourselves.
Love you. Yeah.